Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's a delight to welcome you this evening to this Charles Gore Memorial Lecture, which has been going since about 1935. I think Charles Gore died only a few years before that. He was a canon of Westminster from 1894, I think, until 1902, and then he became serially Bishop of Worcester, and then within 3 years, Bishop of Birmingham, having created the Diocese of Birmingham, and then he went on to be Bishop of Oxford. Then he'd fed up with that in 1919, decided to retire, and lived somewhere in Kensington, I think, for the rest of his life until the 1930s. But he, of course, was a prolific writer and lecturer and one of the most significant of the senior clergy. He founded, of course, the Community of the Resurrection when he was at Pusey House, I think, and continued it when he was here, and then it was eventually established in Merfield, the College of the Resurrection as well. So a significant founder as well as a great theologian and writer. So this lecture is part of the Westminster Abbey Institute's spring program, which is on justice, as you know. Through the Institute, the Abbey seeks to nurture and revitalize moral and spiritual values in public life and service. And it's a great pleasure to welcome this evening the Dean of Trinity College, Cambridge, the Reverend Dr. Michael Banner. You have his biography on your chairs and can read all about him. And he's going to speak on justice, mercy, and remembrance. And there'll be an opportunity at the end of his lecture to ask questions. So stay awake. Professor Banner is going to speak for about 45 minutes, and then will be your opportunity to quiz him on what he's said. Thank you very much, Michael.
Well, I'm very grateful to the Dean and Chapter for the invitation and for the welcome. It's a great pleasure to be here in this fine space and to join in honouring Charles Gore. I have an affinity with him as a Balliol cleric, as he was a Balliol cleric. There could be other things, but I picked that out to begin with, and so I'm glad to be joining in honouring him this evening. In the way of these things, when one's asked to give a lecture 12 months or 14 months ago, one gives a title without knowing what one's going to talk about. So this has now got a subtitle, which is there on the handout. I hope you have the handout that's been prepared. And the subtitle, which is a bit more descriptive, is Christ, Culpability and Social Deprivation. The image known to art historians as Christ on a cold stone achieved huge popularity across especially Northern Europe in the early 15th century. So much so it is that it's this image, not Christ on the cross, which is the typical production of the period. Inevitably, I've had to give you a particular example, and there you've got it in front of you, from Beaune in France. It's in wood, and it's from 1443. But I could have chosen a vast number of similar representations, some in wood, some in stone, and some in painting. And I'd be astonished if there wasn't one somewhere in Westminster Abbey. At least there would have been at one time. In these images, Christ on a cold stone, Christ is shown just before his crucifixion. In this version, a skull by his left foot, you can see it, indicates that Christ is at Golgotha. He's stripped of his cloak, he's crowned with thorns, marked with the wounds of his flagellation, and seated on a stone. And it's a cold stone, just in the sense that it's a place without consolation or comfort. The focus of these images is exactly not Christ's physical suffering, which is currently suspended, but rather his psychological pain or anguish as he awaits his crucifixion. Christ appears abandoned and withdrawn, in deep thought and dejection. But images which are often labelled collectively Christ on his cold stone are by no means all the same, and the particular version of the image I provided draws our attention especially to something I have not yet mentioned, which is that Christ ends his life as a prisoner. A heavy and tightly worn woven crown of thorns binds his head, while his hands and feet are bound by a sinuous rope. By his right foot, you probably can't quite make it out, but maybe you can. By his right foot, there is a small board topped with five or six spikes, a so-called trip block, a device which was designed to knock backwards and forwards between a prisoner's feet or ankles as they walked, so adding to their suffering as they struggled to the gallows. But that trip block, it's there, is now idle, since Christ is going nowhere. Christ, we might say, is bound and bound to die. The popularity of this image tells us that its consumers, if I can put it like that, found in it multiple resonances, and that it was, as we might say, highly effective. One might then speculate, as does the great art historian Emil Mell, that the image's popularity was not merely as a representation of a single imagined moment in the Passion, but more, as he puts it, as its summing up. Through this image, one accessed not just a moment in the story, a single instance, but something of its meaning as a whole. Indeed, in the image in front of us, the figure of Christ refers to something essential to the meaning not just of his passion, but of his life. For it is as a prisoner that Christ most truly represents the humanity which he takes on and takes up in his incarnation. Our humanity is not one of glorious liberty and freedom, for we are all, each and every one, tightly bound by the histories, circumstances, needs, desires, passions and longings which shape our destinies. Thus, as a bound and dejected prisoner, Christ ends his earthly life visibly sharing in the human condition which he has taken on, as a prisoner for the sake of prisoners. On the cold stone, Christ mourns the human condition, our lonely and abject bondage in sin, which he here represents and for which he suffers. It's on account of this bondage that the problem for Christian ethical life, thought and practice, the problem which distinguished it fundamentally from the ethical life, thought and practice of the classical or pagan world, that the problem has always been the problem of the will. In the classical world, the problem of ethics was sometimes conceived as a problem of right, was often conceived as a problem of knowledge. Pagans typically worried about knowing what was the right thing to do, but Christians worried about whether, knowing what to do, they would do it. And they didn't worry a bit, they worried a lot. Or at least they worried a lot if they had learnt their theology from Augustine and not from Britain's first theologian and heretic, Pelagius. Typical that we should produce a heretic first. I say British because his exact provenance within these isles is unknown, though according to the ever-charming Jerome, he was a fat mountain hound weighed down with Scottish porridge. So that suggests a slightly more precise provenance if you're looking for one. For Pelagius, the challenge of the human will might be likened to the challenge of training a puppy to be a good pet. With time and perseverance, you should have a perfectly house-trained and thoroughly reliable companion. But for Augustine, the challenge of training the unruly human will was more like taking a young wolf into your house. You would always be wondering, even as it rested quietly in its basket, whether it might not at any moment revert to its wolfish ways. As Woody Allen has it in another context, the lion will lie down with the lamb, but the lamb won't get much sleep. Now, it was, of course, Augustine's view of human nature which informed the work of that great architect of the Christian world of the Middle Ages, St. Benedict. His rule, the rule of St. Benedict, established the monastery as a school of virtue, just as a pagan philosopher might have established such a school, but with the crucial and distinctly odd feature of the monastic school that, like the Hotel California, you can check in, but you can never check out. The monastic school was not one which had a graduation ceremony, just because the will that it sought to govern was always and ever bound by the ties of sin, represented by those sinuous ropes which constrain Christ as he sits on the cold stone. Augustine's attitude to Pelagius and his complaint against him is contained in that brief observation that the Pelagians heap cruel praise on human nature. Praise because Pelagius would not allow that human nature was the deeply wounded thing that Augustine held it to be. Cruel because Pelagius's praise of human nature led him to the stern moralism which such a favorable appraisal naturally invited. If human nature deserves praise, if human nature is not bound in sin, then our faults and failings can and should be judged the more severely. We really can and should have done better, as school reports used to say. They probably don't anymore. I treasure a school report which said that I made very good use of my limited abilities in art, which I'm happy to have on my tombstone. He made good use of his limited abilities. It seems a fair appraisal. But anyway, for Pelagius, we always could have done better. And so, Augustine argued, Pelagius's praise of human nature was wrong and therefore cruel. Christ on the cold stone, bound, helpless and alone, expresses the human condition as conceived by Augustine. Here on the cold stone, the prisoner who became a prisoner for the sake of prisoners most fully encapsulates and reveals what it is to be human. He is bound, and the trip block, though currently idle, is the token of the full measure of his plight. For even were he to try to stand, his own efforts would be frustrated and punished. Christ on a cold stone is an anthropology wrapped up in a statue, and his popularity in the 15th century witnesses the triumph of Augustine over Pelagius in official teaching and popular piety. So I turn from medieval to the modern world and from a particular prisoner to prisoners in general. And I want to ask whether the Augustinian perspective on the bondage of the will governs our attitudes and policies here and now. Is our criminal justice system, if I can paint with a broad brush, is it Augustinian or is it Pelagian? Do we or do we not reckon with the affliction and disablement of the human will, which Augustine diagnoses and which is represented to us in that statue? And I propose to get at that really rather big question by answering a more specific and smaller one, which nonetheless gets us to the heart of the matter, I think. And that is a question as to whether social deprivation does or should function as a mitigating factor in relation to the sentencing of offenders. And here I need to say a special thank you to a colleague of mine in Cambridge, a friend and colleague of mine in Cambridge who's here this evening, Sir Anthony Bottoms. When I agreed to give this lecture, I didn't know what I was going to talk about, but I decided I wanted to talk about this subject, social deprivation, culpability and mitigation. And Sir Anthony is a world leader in criminology, and he's been extremely generous in offering me guidance and insight. I have to say, and you'll be aware of this, even with the best guide, people go astray. They end up turning left on the glacier when the guide said, whatever you do, don't go on the glacier. So any faults that remain are mine, not his. But I just want to acknowledge his help in providing me with thoughts about these matters. Anyway, so the question I want to ask is this one, whether social deprivation does or should function as a mitigating factor in relation to the sentencing of offenders. Now, if you don't feel inclined, if you don't have an opinion, a strong opinion on that at the moment, quite reasonably in my view, it would be sensible, you might think, to ask, what is the case? What is the case before you declare what should be the case? So let's ask that question. And on the handout I've given you, I've set it out quite clearly, I hope. Let me ask that question. Is social deprivation a mitigating factor in law? Now, the Criminal Justice Act of 2003 holds that the guiding principle of sentencing should be the proportionality of the sentence to the seriousness of the offence. And the seriousness of the offence is defined as having two elements, the harm it causes and the offender's culpability. Now, plainly, the social deprivation of the offender does nothing to touch the harm caused by an offence. Grievous bodily harm is grievous bodily harm. Racial abuse is racial abuse, whether it's whether the offender attended Westminster School, in your own school, Mr. Dean, or whether he was at some much rougher establishment at the other end of the spectrum, like St. Paul's. That was a joke, by the way, yeah, but yeah, I don't know whether there was one. And good, good. Okay. But does social deprivation have a bearing on culpability as the law sees it? So it's got no bearing, obviously, on gravity, on harm, but does it have it on culpability? The Sentencing Guideline Council, which rules on these things, has issued guidance on this element, culpability, in establishing the seriousness of offence, and it allows that culpability may be reduced depending on whether the offender intends to cause harm, is reckless about causing it, has knowledge of the risks, or is negligent. So these guidelines construe culpability, in other words, as a scale running from deliberately intended to negligently allowed. And to such a scale, again, social deprivation is plainly irrelevant. A socially deprived individual either intends to damage the car, is reckless about damaging the car, or whatever they might be, whatever it might be, their social deprivation does not, as such, affect culpability if it's so conceived. But that's not the end of the story, for the Criminal Justice Act provides rather helpfully, or not as you see it, at section 166, provides that nothing in the preceding sections prevents a court from mitigating an offender's sentence by taking into account any such matters as, in the opinion of the court, are relevant in mitigation of sentence, which is a rather wide clause. So even after the court has reflected on and determined the seriousness of offence, there is a second moment in the process of sentencing when mitigation, so-called personal mitigation, may bear on a sentence, at which moment social deprivation may, it seems, according to the law, get a look in. Indeed, pleas in mitigation, intended to contribute to a sentence's reflections on mitigation, these pleas in mitigation absolutely assume that social deprivation really does count at this point. But does it? In seeking to answer that question, in seeking to understand practice and thinking around mitigation, two researchers, Jacobson and Howe, or Huff, undertook an empirical study which had two elements. First, an analysis of 132 actual cases involving sentences being passed on 162 defendants, and second, interviews with practicing sentencers in which the views of these sentences, Crown Court judges and the like, were elicited by questions and by exploration of certain scenarios. Now, I'm not in the context of this lecture going to go into the details of study, you wouldn't want me to, but let me provide you with a sense of its flavour and conclusions, which are that in practice, I'll give you the conclusion straight up, that sentences do not allow social deprivation to mitigate a sentence. Let me give a single example from the study. The researchers put to experienced sentencers different scenarios, in one of which an imagined defendant, the imagined defendant was 22 years old with several previous convictions for shoplifting. The defendant pleads guilty to a charge of burglary, the victim being a 76-year-old woman who was alone in her house at the time. One of the possible mitigating factors is that the defendant is functionally illiterate. His mother discouraged school attendance, and he's never had a regular job. That's one mitigating factor. Another is that he had physically and emotionally abusive parents and spent his childhood mainly in care. So these two factors, they're not, don't equate with social deprivation as such, but they reasonably may be taken to be associated with it. So how weighty did the sentencers consider these two factors to be? All you need to know is that the two factors I mentioned came bottom of the list of 13 possible factors. They came in 13th place and 11th equal, joint with another, so in the bottom places. 40 of the respondents, there was some variation, but 40 of the respondents, not one of the 40 respondents thought that a physically and emotionally abused childhood spent mostly in care should have a big impact on mitigating a sentence, and only one sentencer would allow the impact of the fact of being functionally illiterate as being as a result of being discouraged from attending school. So the broad consensus among the sentences was that these two factors should have minimal or no impact rather than some. Looking at their study as a whole, the researchers ask, what is the relationship between mitigation and disadvantage? And they answer that the evidence from our research is that there are manifold contradictions in this relationship. The only contradiction I can see is that defense advocates routinely assume that sentences are swayed by accounts of their clients' social deprivation when they do pleas in mitigation, whereas the evidence from the surveys of actual decisions made and of responses given to these scenarios is quite simply that, and I quote, sentences appear to be somewhat immune to accounts of disadvantage. So, to take stock, while Section 166 of the Criminal Justice Act seems to allow in principle that social deprivation may mitigate a sentence, in practice it doesn't. So let me ask the question, should it? And let me turn to a work of two noted authors, one Andrew Ashworth, a joint work between Andrew Ashworth and his colleague von Hirsch, Proportionate Sentencing, the two, I think, noted and leading authorities in the field. And their discussion, I think, is interesting, though I think mistaken. They conclude that social disadvantage should mitigate a sentence, that's their recommendation, but as a matter of compassion, not as reducing culpability. Their reasoning for saying that is, I think, fairly unexceptional. The reason that it should count for something is unexceptional. Social disadvantage, they say, alters the stakes which individuals have in keeping the law. To take a very obvious point, depending on what you can or can't easily afford to buy, theft is more or less tempting. I don't find it tempting to steal an iPhone. I could go and buy one. Similarly, I would be rather troubled by the social stigma that would attach to being convicted of stealing an iPhone if I come from certain places in the social strata with little to lose. I may not care about the social stigma. So, as they put it, the deprived offender is in a more troubled situation, one in which the temptations to offend become harder to resist. But this circumstance, that it's harder to resist, though it deserves compassion, they say, does not warrant the view that the disadvantaged are less culpable if they do offend. Why? And I give you the quotation on the sheet so you can see it. To make a case that an offender is less culpable for his crime would seem to require that almost anyone in his situation would find it extraordinarily difficult to desist, that compliance would be a matter of heroism or something akin to that. But many individuals in deprived neighbourhoods remain law-abiding. In other words, more self-disciplined persons will still be able to comply, and it is only the more susceptible ones who may not. And thus, as they see it, these offenders deserve compassion, but they can't be considered less culpable. I think that's a bit of a muddle. It's not a muddle that maybe makes any difference in practice. I'm glad that they think compassion does suggest we should mitigate sentences on account of social deprivation. And if I were in court and the court handed down a non-custodial sentence on account of my social deprivation, I'm sure I wouldn't be too concerned as to whether they did it on the grounds of compassion or whether they did it on reflecting on my reduced culpability. Either way, I would be grateful. But I think we ought to get straight about the thinking here, for the reason that von Hirsch and Ashworth's disinclination to recognise the case for allowing diminished culpability seems to involve a failure to understand the nature of the connections between social deprivation and crime, and risks perpetuating what I take to be a mistaken attitude to offending from those who are socially deprived. So remember their claim that to make a case that the socially deprived offender is less culpable, his crime would seem to require that almost anyone in his situation would find it extraordinarily difficult to desist, that compliance would be a matter of heroism. I wonder whether von Hirsch and Ashworth may have been somewhat misled by what other researchers have called a criminological puzzle, or even the paradox of social deprivation and crime, namely that although most persistent offenders come from disadvantaged backgrounds, most people from disadvantaged backgrounds do not become persistent offenders. Most criminals are socially deprived, but the socially deprived are mostly not criminals. That's what they call the puzzle or the paradox. Now, plainly, as these researchers suggest, what is needed to solve this seeming puzzle is a better understanding of the mechanisms through which social disadvantage is implicated in the development of persistent offending. And what they propose is that just amongst the socially disadvantaged, those who offend have what they call a high crime propensity and a higher exposure to a criminogenic context. Crime propensity is a matter of morality or lack of it and ability to exercise self-control, and exposure to these, that word I find difficult to say, criminogenic context, is a matter of being placed in a context conducive to engagement in acts of crime, that's to say in contexts where the rules of law are loosely applied and or weakly enforced. So that is their account. And I think this research, and I've given you the reference to it there, I think this research is compelling, though there are nuances which one might discuss. But, since as the researchers themselves suggest, possessing a high crime propensity and being more often exposed to criminogenic context is itself a function of social deprivation, I think we can conclude as follows, that although it is misleading to say that social deprivation is a cause of crime, just in the sense that the vast majority of the socially deprived are not criminals, it is true to say that social deprivation is a cause of the causes of crime. So, to go back to von Hirsch and Ashworth, in shying away from allowing that social deprivation may reduce culpability, they seem to have been impressed by the fact that the socially deprived generally don't offend. But within the group of the socially defined, if we identify subpopulations more narrowly, the figures look very, very different. According to data published by the Cabinet Office in 2002, 65% of boys with a convicted father will themselves go on to offend. To take another set of figures, a child in care in this country is 15 times more likely to be criminalised in any one year than one of their peers not in care. Furthermore, 70% of those who do offend while in care will have been taken into care because of acute family stress, family dysfunction, parental illness, disability or absence. And a further 14% of those who offend while in care were taken into care primarily because of abuse or neglect, giving us a total of 84% of those who offend while in care coming from deeply distressed circumstances. Numbers of that kind can be examined, investigated, chopped up, and they deserve analysis. But on the face of it, they surely allow us to hold just what von Hirsch and Ashworth required we should hold, if social deprivation is to count as a mitigating factor, which is just that it is the truly exceptional individual who doesn't offend. If 65% of boys with a convicted father go on to offend, compliance for such a boy is plainly a minority achievement. And I doubt very much that heroism, von Hirsch and Ashworth's term, that heroism constitutes a good explanation of an individual's avoiding a conviction. In the way of things, it may be something altogether more banal as pure and simple moral luck. Things fell out in such a way that the occasions and opportunity which might have led them to offend didn't arise. There was no exposure, as the researchers would put it. But it's hard to see that the fact that a few young men, by sheer good fortune, don't have occasion to offend should prevent our holding that those who do have lesser culpability. I suspect that what we're hitting up against here is the legacy, to mention a big thing, the legacy of the Enlightenment, which makes us disinclined to entertain the thought that we are in general, and some in particular ways, bound to sin, to borrow the title of a book which explores this theme. Disinclined, that is, to entertain the anthropology of Augustine, which reckons with the bondage of the will and its implications for the criminal justice system. Were we to do so, we would have to accept that there are criminal acts which are fully and unequivocally intended, and yet for which the actor may lack culpability, just in the sense that their choices may be theirs and may be wrong, their pattern of choosing itself, and very importantly, is not of their choosing. If the Enlightenment's refusal of the bondage of the will is one factor in our thinking, another and more recent one is the matter of current fashion in criminology, where some find that there is a turn against what you might call a political economy approach to crime, which would seek to understand social deviance in its wider historical and social setting, in favour of what's been termed realism. Realism here indicates an impatience with trying to fathom the origins of criminality and a preference for simply identifying those levers, such as changes in patterns in policing or an increase in prison terms or whatever it might be, which might be thought to affect a reduction in crime. But whether it's current fashion or the legacy of the Enlightenment which prevents our acknowledging the lesser culpability of socially deprived offenders, these blocks to a proper appreciation of our social conditions need to be overcome. We need, I suggest, to accept that we've created a society in which individuals receive as a woeful birthright a criminal destiny. Of course, the story of most criminality can be told, almost certainly can be told, as a story in which individuals take individual decisions which bring them face to face with the courts. But those stories are themselves part of larger histories in which individuals learn patterns of perception, judgment, and behaviour such that their later decisions and conduct look more determined than innocently chosen. This is not to deny choice, but it is to say with Ricoeur that sin sometimes lies behind an action more than actually in it. And I want to make a distinction here. You don't have to make this distinction, but I want to make it. You can make it a different distinction, but I want to make a distinction between fate and destiny. You don't have to. But given the distinction, that distinction, criminality, we might say, is a matter of fate. It's not a matter of fate, but it's very often a matter of destiny. We can think of fate as what befalls us in a Greek manner, what befalls us whatever we do, no matter what we do. Thought of like that, fate pursues us in spite even of the choices we make against it. Thus, Oedipus is a victim of fate, just in the sense that no matter his twists and turns, he ends up unwittingly marrying his mother. It didn't matter what he did, he was going to end up marrying his mother. We might think of destiny differently. Destiny is not an external force determining our histories, but can be thought of as an internal one, written in our natures, not in the stars. So when we follow our destinies, unlike Oedipus, we willingly and knowingly intend our crimes rather than committing them unwittingly. So if we allow, as we should, that the human will can be sequestered, colonized, co-opted by social dynamics which determine our choosing, we may say that in some cases, criminality is best thought of as a destiny and not as a simple, innocent, or uncomplicated choice. I headed the next section on being practical and not religious. A friend of mine, taking questions on a similar occasion as this, faced a very cross questioner who, as is often the way of these things, but perhaps not under the Dean's chairmanship, often the way of these things, didn't ask a question but made a statement. And the statement being that the lecturer had been unfair to those who took a view other than his own. To which my friend replied quite fairly, I thought, that it had never been his intention to be fair to those who took a different view. Now, someone might say that I've not been practical, but then it was not my intention to be practical. But let me say two things about that. First, nothing of what I've just said is meant to suggest that regular findings of moral or legal culpability don't have their place in even their own validity. It is to say, however, that they have their limits, and that such findings have to be placed in a wider and more adequate perspective of moral reflection. I'm not proposing that we close the courts tomorrow, but I am saying that we should look behind the regular judgments which the courts make and the assumptions on which they operate to consider deeper questions of anthropology, which naturally enough are not the immediate concern of the courts. I've picked up a thread of thought about culpability, specifically in relation to the matter of mitigation of sentence, but I am suggesting, but I'm further suggesting, of course, that were we to keep pulling on this thread, we might unravel quite a bit of the tapestry of the criminal justice system. For once we reckon with the fact of the bondage of the will, as I've termed it, the fact that there are criminal destinies which may explain criminal choices, we would surely look at the whole system of criminal justice with rather different eyes, finding out, I would suggest, largely insensitive to the plight of those who are bound to sin. Of course, an objector might also go on to say that the most impractical element of my impractical thoughts on this matter is just that I've been religious in a secular age. I guess in Westminster Abbey that would count as a plea in mitigation, or I don't know, rather than defence, but I'm being religious in a secular age. What is the intellectual currency of that image of Christ on the cold stone from which I started and the anthropology which it presupposes? What's its intellectual currency when such a starting point is one which secular, social, and political thought eschews? I would insist, however, that the anthropology I commend from a Christian point of view, with its particular conception of the travails of human agency, can and indeed should commend itself to reflective secular thought. There is something slightly odd to say, in the latter-day triumph of Pelagius's thinking, consisting as it does in the cruel praise heaped on human nature. And with the denial of that nature's moral affliction. Pelagius's great moment came not in the 5th century. He really didn't have many great moments in the 5th century, when he was pursued by Augustine root and branch. But his great moment came with the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, with those moments in intellectual life and thought which had as their Christian counterpoints, Martin Luther writing on the bondage of the will, and Jonathan Edwards writing on free will and original sin. His time in the sun came when thinkers such as Joseph Priestley could confidently announce that, let me read this, it's wonderful, whatever was the beginning of this world, the end will be glorious and paradisical, beyond what our imaginings can conceive. Men will make their situation in the world abundantly more easy and comfortable. They will probably prolong their existence in it and will grow daily more happy. Such will it be after Brexit, I think we're to believe. But that's what Priestley says about human history from the 18th century on. But here is the deep irony, men will grow daily more happy. Here's the deep irony, that it was not Luther or Edwards who most tellingly announced the death knell on the Renaissance and Enlightenment's sunny Pelagian optimism regarding human nature, but that greatest of Enlightenment thinkers, Immanuel Kant himself, the man who achieved the Enlightenment's greatest feats of thought and intellect, even whilst at the same time drawing boundaries to the Enlightenment's most vaunting ambition and optimism. In relation to human nature, Kant in effect declares himself for Luther, stating in Religion Within the Boundaries of Mere Reason that human beings are born in bondage to radical evil, can only be liberated by a divine grace, the existence of which cannot, however, be known to theoretical reason. But if that isn't enough to discomfort or disconcert any latter-day Pelagians, we might add that any happy Enlightenment thoughts about human nature run into the roadblock not only of the late 18th century, but also of the 19th, in which Marx, Darwin, Nietzsche, and Freud, those great masters of suspicion, and great prophets for the church, fathers of the church in my view, paint a picture in their very different ways of human action as darkly determined. Augustine won the war once in the 5th century, he won it again in the 18th, he won it again in the 19th, even if it still remains for him to win the peace. back to Augustine. Always good to go back to Augustine. Preaching in his cathedral church in Hippo around 418, Augustine starts, as he did, with the gospel for the day. That wondrous and beautiful story of the raising of the only son of the widow of Nain from Luke's gospel. But he quickly gets to the raising of Lazarus by a very, very curious route. He notes that besides the story of the widow's son, the widow of Nain's son, there are two other stories of Christ raising the dead in the Gospels. And the dead in each case, you may not have noticed this, are raised in different places. Don't know whether you've ever noticed that. In the case of the widow's son, Christ meets the burial party at the town walls as he enters Nain. They're leaving, for the son was due to be buried, as Jews were buried, as Christ were buried, without a city wall. And he raises the son there and then at the city wall, halfway between house and tomb. Jairus' daughter, however, you recall, he's the leader of the synagogue. He comes begging at Christ's feet for his sick daughter, only for the word to reach him that the girl is dead, and for Jesus to press on regardless. Jairus' daughter was raised inside the four walls of her parents' house. The third resurrectee, Lazarus, was raised not at home, not halfway from home to grave, but from the tomb itself, where he had lain for 4 days, and, as the authorized version so memorably has it, stinketh. Now, says Augustine, these three people in their different locations represent three sorts of sinners whom Christ is raising even now. We might think of them as those who are a bit dead in sin, very dead in sin, and very, very dead in sin. Jairus' daughter, still in her house, is like people who have sin inside their hearts, but don't yet have it in actual deed. They have not carried it out. The widow's son at the gates is like someone who moves from consenting to the wicked thought to putting it into practice. Someone who has carried it out, if you like, just as the son of the widow had been carried out to the city walls. And what of the one who is 4 days dead and stinketh? He is like the one who is very, very dead in sin, who has added habit to sinful actions such that it becomes addiction. The sorry state of the latter is shown by the fact, says Augustine, that while Christ raises the other two with a simple and gentle command, he raises Lazarus with a great shout. Lazarus, come out! Great shout. He has to speak loudly enough to wake the very dead. Now, as if this was not enough for one morning, his congregation already reeling under this, he reminds his congregation that though Lazarus was summoned by Jesus, he emerges with his hands and feet bound with strips of cloth and his face wrapped in a cloth, so that Christ has to address an instruction to the bystanders, unbind him and let him go. This, he says, is the office he gave to the disciples. There is a need for the person who has come back to life to be unbound, absolved, and allowed to walk free. So the sermon, as you see, preached randomly in 418, the sermon reprises Augustine's anthropology, the anthropology of Christ on the cold stone, for it is Lazarus who emerges bound and is most manifestly bound to sin. All three of the dead are dead in sin and bound together and in sin and death. And it draws out the moral from his anthropology, that it is the office of a disciple to unbind those whom Christ is bringing back to life. At the beginning of that sermon, he makes what I take to be a very telling remark. Augustine says, not all have the wherewithal to see that those who are dead in heart rise again. To see that, you need to have already risen in the heart, in your heart yourself. It is perhaps then the peculiar and special office of the church, the special office of the disciple of Christ, of those who acknowledge and experience renewal of heart in Christ. It's their special office to speak to the criminal justice system of both the binding and the unbinding of the human will. It is the binding of the human will which creates the criminal destinies which are imposed on many of the socially deprived, and the possibility of the unbinding of the will in spite of sin, which taken together should cause us to look at our criminal justice system with sharply critical eyes. I've looked at one small detail of that system this evening, but I suggest that the detail I've looked at provides a perspective on the whole. Our criminal justice system is too often Pelagian, not seeming to reckon with the fact of criminal destinies. It doesn't take account of the fact that many are bound in sin. And if we followed the offender from court to prison, we would too often find a system which is more likely to bind the offender further than it is to help in fashioning new and better destinies. Indeed, and even worse to say, if we were to follow offenders beyond the prison gate after they are released, we would find practices and attitudes which leave their bindings firmly in place. The sublime image of Christ on a cold stone invites us to see ourselves and other selves in Christ the prisoner, Christ bound as we are bound and bound for our sakes. Taught by the anthropology expressed in that statue, we might learn to say, as Augustine used to say when he implored magistrates to show leniency towards convicted criminals, we might learn to say, "I, a sinner, plead before you, a sinner, for the sake of sinners." And then we might also, as a society, hear that great command, "Unbind him." Thank you very much.
Good, so now an opportunity to ask some questions and possibly even make some comments. But I'll go first, which I often do. At one time, imprisonment was just punishment. And then it began to be thought of as an opportunity for redemption. And then Michael Howard said, you know, just put them away. That's the right thing to do. But you're suggesting, I think, that there is no hope for people who are destined to criminality. So what's the point of prison?
I was rather saying that, I think the double perspective, I want the bound and the unbound. I mean, I think we should reckon seriously with the destinies which create criminals, which should encourage us to think seriously about the mitigation of sentence. I mean, people who come with certain criminal destinies should not be sentenced as other people are sentenced. But I'm also saying that Christians believe, and quite rightly believe, and we've got criminologists who believe in the possibility of redemption and an unbinding, but that unbinding is a task. And I think, well, we could discuss, this could be discussed in detail, and we hear people who know this more than I do, but one of the problems with prisons is that the very best prisons, a colleague of Sir Anthony Bottom's, Alison Liebling in Cambridge, has written well on what makes a good prison. The very best prisons do a good job at unbinding people. Age also has an effect. As people get older, they tend not to offend so much. But good prisons do that well. But most of our prisons are not good prisons.
Now, there are some microphones around.
I just said, Dean, he's very kind. Henry Chadwick, a colleague of mine, when someone had given a lecture, would say things like, "I could hear every word you said," or "you kept to time."
But you kept to time.
Yeah, well, that's a high compliment.
And I could hear every word you said. Now, who would like to ask a question, make a comment? Yes, sir. So just here at the front. Thank you very much. No, just over here. Sorry. You have to see where I'm pointing. Thank you.
Thank you for a very thought-provoking talk. Indeed, I could hear every word too. We've heard a certain amount of the perpetrators of crime and of the criminal justice system. For many crimes, there is also a victim. And I know one or two whose criminal experiences as victims have left them quite bound up as well in that. Where should we be talking of, and in doing more than talking, acting in terms of binding and unbinding with the victims of crime?
That's an office which belongs to the church as well, and belongs to Christian disciples. So I'm not, in speaking about offenders, I'm not saying we shouldn't speak of victims. And of course, there are lots of interesting programs around rehabilitation which seek to connect victims with offenders as a reconciling and healing act for both parties. So certainly we should talk about it.
So, yes, over here. I think. Yes, very good.
I was actually trying to point out the lady over there, but as it happens,
I do
have a question in my mind. I work as a volunteer with the chaplaincy at HMP Rochester. If, as I believe it is, background is a mitigating factor, for me the problem is it indefinitely a mitigating factor? Again, and again, and again. Because some of these people, though their background is appalling, are pretty bright. And they know the outcome of their actions. Their background remains the same. Should their background be indefinitely, for any number of sentences, a mitigating factor?
I think, well, there's lots of questions, things we're going to discuss there. We ought to ask a question about what are we doing with people who offend to enable them to desist from offending. And in some sense, I mean, this is a theoretical sort of discussion, but in some sense, of course, theoretically, one would say, yes, insofar as we don't do much to help them desist from offending, yes, their background should go on constituting an excuse for a very long time. You know, so while we fail, as I think our prisons often do, and the criminal justice system often does fail to address adequately the deep reasons why people are offending, then it would go on being an excuse. But no, I mean, you know, if we had a system that addressed that. And I don't want to say that there aren't hardened criminals who calculatingly, you know, think this is the best thing for them. I'm talking about, you know, the examples I took. I don't think they're the examples you're thinking of. The examples I took were of, for example, of children who get criminalised in care. That they're not the sort of people I think you're thinking of.
Yes, there was a lady there, I think. Is that right? Yes, with white hair. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I was wondering about you talked about the puzzle of the many who are socially deprived but do not become criminal offenders. And you, I thought, implied that the reason why they didn't was just that they had a lot more good luck. Is this really an adequate explanation?
No, I didn't say that. I said two. I'm merely referring to the research. The research says that. So we've got. If you imagine this vast circle, the socially deprived. You know, the so-called puzzle or paradox is not really a paradox. It might be a puzzle. Is if you go into prison, nearly everyone you meet is socially deprived. If you say, well, therefore, social deprivation, you know, is a cause of crime, you've made a fallacious inference because the pool of the socially deprived in prison is very small. So most prisoners are socially deprived, but the socially deprived are not most don't end up offending. But the research says two things. It says that if you want to sort of work out who amongst the socially deprived will offend, you will find that they suffer from they have a propensity to crime, which could be a sort of word that covers nothing, but they identify as failure to inability to control one's temper and actions very well, and Tony, what's the other bit? Morality. Oh yeah, lack of morality. That's one thing, and the other is exposure. And those two things together. Now, all I said about that was that those two factors are themselves socially related to social deprivation. In other words, if I have not had the life circumstances which have trained me to think or have caused me to think in moral terms about my actions and have given me the ability to control my anger's passion, with young men angers, my anger, if I've not had that upbringing, that's a function of social deprivation. And if I find myself in circumstances where occasions to commit offences are quite easy and enforcement is low, and that's a function of social deprivation. If I live in on certain housing estates in certain places, there is little enforcement. So social deprivation again comes in. So I'm not saying it's just luck, but I was saying that if those who come into this category themselves don't offend, it may be because they just happen to be lucky on the afternoon when there was exposure and they had the propensity, they happened to be watching something on telly. You know, so they didn't steal a telly because they were watching telly, but that was luck. So I'm not saying luck is the total explanation. I'm saying it's one of the factors. And if you're saying why did these people who had the propensity and possibly, you know, didn't offend?
But I think we got two. So the gentleman here near the second row, good.
Hi, thank you. I think there's probably a lot I could ask. I'm going to start by being boring and probably make a comment, but I hope it's quite, well, maybe a little bit illuminating from an anecdotal point of view. So, like this gentleman here, I volunteer in two different prisons, HMP Bullingdon and Spring Hill, which is an open prison in Buckinghamshire. I guess anecdotally speaking, I've got to know in the last 18 months probably 12 prisoners quite well. Of those 12, 11 come from what you would consider socially deprived backgrounds. Now, I think the reason I tell this as an anecdote is that I think what was alarming of the evidence, the study from Jacobson and his colleague about the idea that those two things that ranked below, and one of them was literacy. Now, of those 11 people, 7 of them I calculated while you were talking, I would say have the reading age of between a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old. One of the things that's become apparent to me over the last 18 months is, I think it's two things. Not only does the complete lack of literacy impound employment possibilities, which further drags them down, it also, and I think this is probably a little bit more nuanced, it really suffocates the ability to express what lies within. And when you come from a socially deprived background already, the inability to express nuanced emotions mean that you're left with your basic things, and anger so often seems to be the case. If I then focus, sorry to go on a little bit, but if I then focus on the open prison, which sort of contrary to what you would imagine is actually full of people serving considerable sentences, often up to life, I've got to know 5 people within that system, and of those, it's amazing what you talked about from that study from Jacobson and his colleague, because of those 5, 4 of them both come from a criminal family and are highly illiterate. So I say that by way of illumination, and then I guess it just leads me on to my question, which is actually, given what seems to be the report's sort of how it highlights how criminal justice, judges in the criminal justice system seem to wholly ignore such mitigating factors, what is it that we do? How can I, as a layperson, who in an experience of 18 months can come across such incredible situations that lead me both to a compassionate understanding of these people and an understanding that it should act in mitigation, how is it that that criminal justice judges don't seem to have the same exposure, and what can we do to fix that?
So I'd like to, I mean, first of all, I'd say one thing about other studies. There are, you know, I took one study. There are other studies which suggest other things. I don't actually think this is not my area of expertise, but I've not seen the studies which persuade me that that study is wrong. I have to say, if you read the study, I'd like to say this clearly. If you read the study, the judges, the sentences, they're not all judges, some of them I think are magistrates, but the sentences come over as deeply compassionate people. They don't come over as, you know, bullish, you know, harsh or whatever. They don't come over as that. They come over as people, and this is my anecdotal impression of the study, they come over as people who are very, very concerned to try and do the right thing. And I guess what you'd say they're overwhelmed by is the fact that everyone they see is socially deprived. So I can see why that, you know, in some sense, I suppose they're saying, well, if I mitigate for one, I'd mitigate for all. So maybe because it's for all, it doesn't count for any. So that could be one explanation for it. What can you do? I mean, I suppose, look, I mean, where does one start? I do Thought for the Day from time to time, and the Thought for the Day, they say, well, you know, you've got to talk about the fact that the Prime Minister's might resign tomorrow, you know, the news, and then you say, well, yeah, but I do that every week. Can we do something different? But anyway, but you know, normally they sort of tell you something. But when they're a bit stuck for news, I always know what I can do. I can always type in prison, and I can find on page 27, you know, way down, it's not covered, I can find way down some story about a prison where people are being denied books, where there's no training, where people are not being let out of their cells, where people, you know, where there are infestation of cockroaches in cells, where people are not being allowed access to their children. I can find week after week after week stories of inhumane treatment in prisons. I think it is a Christian duty to speak on behalf of those prisoners for whom our Lord Jesus Christ was himself a prisoner. That's what we can do.
So we've got two more, and that'll be that. So gentleman there, and then lady in the second row here.
I'd just like to say, in terms of the...
Hold it up, please.
In terms of the argument, I am a Pelagian in that I do believe that there is something glorious about human nature, that reason and love are the human heritage. I teach mindfulness in schools, and the point of teaching mindfulness is to try and get children, and us, because we tend not to do it as well, to pay attention to everything that we're doing and to live in the present. And that is open to everybody. And that is part of our heritage. And it can cancel any social deprivation. Everybody has this ability, in my experience, to pay attention and to learn to love, because the two are very similar. If you pay attention to something, you love it. And so I think all children and all prisoners are teachable, and we have to believe that. And to believe that there's some destiny really perpetuates the problem.
No, I made a... I obviously wasn't clear. I made a distinction between fate and destiny. Augustine believes that human nature is glorious. That's why he's concerned about it. He thinks it's glorious but wounded. And what it needs recovery from is the wound. You say you're a Pelagian. I beg to believe that you couldn't be such a terrible thing.
So the ladies...
Essential element of Pelagianism is a cruel moralism. It's what is the essence of Pelagian. Pelagian was an ascetic. That's what he was. He went around telling people they could and should have done better. And he didn't believe in grace, and he didn't really believe in sin. So Pelagianism is cruel praise. It's what, you know, when you mentioned certain Home Secretaries, that's what Pelagian involves. It's sort of sense that, you know, they're criminals, they deserve it, they should be punished. Throw away the, you know, put them in the cell and throw away the key. That's what Pelagianism is. Yep. You're not a Pelagian.
I wonder if I could add one more question or comment to the element of morality, which you raised. You only said the word once in the whole process, which was interesting. I spent 20 years working in the criminal justice sector, monitoring first detainees in police stations and then prisoners in transit. And I've met a lot of very young people from complicated backgrounds, and I've been a teacher in both the schools you quoted too, which was interesting. But the point I'd like to make is that children who come from the sort of circumstance that from which you drew your statistics from the Howard League paper, so the 85%, most of whom have been in care, don't have a moral compass because it's frozen by their social deprivation. There's a feral response, a lack of trust. On the whole, the chain that you describe as destiny is one that the social deprivation is surely society failing to intervene to stop that deprivation being deprivation. It isn't financial, it's a moral duty from the whole of society which has caused a lot of this. What's your view on the reduction of the number of people who end up as illustrations of your discussion by early intervention? In the prevention, it's the taking of children into care tends to be, especially with young ones, children who don't have choice, free will, a concept of what is right and what is wrong, because they don't dare to develop one.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I fully got all your question, but if you're saying that giving children moral education is important and important in relation to crime, I think the evidence supports you.
May I come back to you? Sorry, one doesn't usually, but I'd like to. It isn't a moral education. It's their circumstance means there is no capacity for moral development. Sure. How does society intervene to stop that happening?
I think I'm going to hold forth on how society can intervene in relation to families. I mean, it's a complicated matter, but the problem is plainly a crucial one in relation to the existence of young offenders and older offenders.
Well, look, that's we'll finish now. There'll be a chance afterwards just for a few moments of conversation as Michael and I leave. But, Michael, thank you very much indeed. A very interesting, fascinating lecture, brilliantly done, if I may say, and a really important topic. I spent some time at HMP Grendon when I was at Theological College, and I found that completely fascinating because the young people I was engaged with there, they were so hopeless, frankly, and it was so desperate. I was not there as a criminal.
No,
thank God. But
I just wanted to clarify.
That. It's worth clarifying. It was the most fascinating experience. In the end, I do think education has an enormous contribution to make. Really, really good education from a very early age can move people out of those circumstances. But there are so many who simply don't get it. Thank you so much for coming tonight. Thank you, Michael, enormously for your lecture. And justice continues. Thank you very much.